Good morning, everyone. I'm calling to order the hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I know everyone's probably tired. We were here in the evening last night. So thanks, everybody, for being here this morning. We have a lot of work to get to, so we're going to get right to it. We don't have minutes this morning. Of course, when we do, we'll bring those up at another hearing. So the first bill for today is House File 2422, Representative Herr. And Representative Herr's motion will be, Representative Herr, were you, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, I understand. Okay. So Representative Herr's motion is that House File 2422 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and Representative Herr, I don't see any amendment to the bill, so I think we're set to go, and please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. The bill before you would dedicate and a potential funds from the Juul lawsuit to Minnesota's tobacco prevention and treatment efforts. In 2020, the state of Minnesota sued Juul, Altria, and four of its subsidiaries, taking a stand to protect consumers and the health of Minnesota kids. Most of us are aware of Juul and how they, along with other e-cigarette manufacturers, are responsible for the youth nicotine epidemic. Juul developed sleek-looking products with menthol and candy flavors designed to appeal to kids with sky-high nicotine levels to addict users. Each Juul pod contains more nicotine than a pack of cigarettes. Juul's early advertising failed to mention that the devices contained any nicotine at all. Investigations have found that Juul used several pages from Big Tobacco's playbook and targeted kids as young as 8 with a marketing program including summer camp, school programs, and hundreds of social media influencers. The state is set to go to trial with Juul at the end of this month. Minnesota is a leader in holding Big Tobacco accountable. In the 1990s, Minnesota took an aggressive approach to suing the tobacco industry for the harms caused by their deadly products. We dedicated only a small fraction of those dollars to tobacco prevention and treatment. This past year, the state of Minnesota collected nearly $800 million in tobacco taxes and settlement fees, but less than 1.5%, or $11.7 million of that, was spent on tobacco prevention and treatment. Today, we have the chance to learn from the past and dedicate any potential funds and funds to proven commercial tobacco prevention and treatment programs at MDH. These funds aren't a tax. They aren't being pulled away from the general fund, and they are coming from an industry that caused our state and our children harm. Let's spend those dollars wisely. Madam Chair, with that, that's the close of my opening statement, and I do have testifiers here today. If I will yield the rest of my time.
Yes, thank you very much, Representative Herr. So I have on the list Elise Less. Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay.
Yeah, and we do need you to be pretty brief because we have a very full agenda, so
okay.
Thank you.
It's down to a little over 2 minutes. Okay. Yes. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Elise Levine Less. I'm the Executive Director of Tobacco Free Alliance, and I am here today on behalf of the Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation in support of the bill before you. I've seen the harm Juul products have caused and the role Juul played in the ongoing youth vaping epidemic firsthand. You may think that public health has won the war on youth tobacco use, and in fact, youth cigarette smoking rates are at their lowest point ever. However, thanks to Juul and its targeted marketing to young people, its compact and easy to conceal design and its formulation to smoothly inhale high amounts of nicotine, we didn't really get rid of the youth tobacco problem. It has instead morphed into a youth e-cigarette vaping problem of epidemic proportions, which started when Juul came on the market. I've talked with hundreds of Minnesota teens about vaping in our work. We now have a generation who can't imagine someone lighting up a cigarette on an airplane or at a restaurant, but nonchalantly describe classmates vaping in the back of math class into their sleeve and wading through a sea of students in the bathroom, passing around a mint-flavored vape just so they can get to the stall. Youth nicotine dependence remains at epidemic levels, and adequate funding is needed to support prevention and treatment. 14% of 11th graders and 7% of 8th graders in Minnesota reported using e-cigarettes in 2022. Young people say often that they turn to vaping as a coping mechanism to alleviate stress. One student told me, quote,
people get so stressed. They think that once they hit the jewel or something and they get that next new buzz, that they feel good and they're ready to go on, end quote. Teens do not intend to get addicted to nicotine and underestimate the risk. They are surprised at how easy it is to lose control and become nicotine dependent. As one Minnesota teen from our 2019 focus group study explained, I used to only vape at school for the buzz, and then things got a little bit rough in life, then I got a little bit addicted, and it just kind of went downhill from there, end quote. The connection between mental health problems and youth e-cigarette use has only become worse post-COVID, and in fact, the 2022 Minnesota Student Survey found a strong connection between long-term mental health problems and youth e-cigarette use.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
I am going to wrap up. Thank you very much, Chair. Juul settlement funds should help address the lasting impact of the e-cigarette epidemic, and ease the countless health impacts of the tobacco industry's unjust targeting. We have a chance here to hold them accountable and use the money to invest in youth prevention and to help all those who are now addicted to quit. It's too important of a chance to pass up. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I don't have anyone else on the list. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. So, members, questions and discussion. Representative Perryman.
Yes, thank you, Madam Speaker. Representative, thank you for bringing the bill. It's not the microphone. It was me not pulling it down. So, I just have a quick question, and that is there any existing special revenue accounts now for other tobacco settlements?
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Levine, and thank you, Representative Perryman, for that question. So there is, this is, I guess I want to understand, are you saying like does an account already exist right now for
yes,
this?
Yes, for any tobacco settlements that might be, Madam Chair. Yeah. Yes, any other accounts set for a tobacco settlement.
Madam Chair, Representative Perryman, sorry. Boy, we're all over the place today. Sorry, Madam Chair.
We're all tired. All right.
No, there. So we actually have based this language on the tobacco settlement, and so there's language that already exists from the tobacco settlement, and this is just adding additional language into that so that we can actually direct it for specifically for the Juul settlement.
Representative Perryman?
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. And I'm just curious. That was my question. So this language only it only exists because you need a mechanism to deal with that Juul settlement. But will it effectively be put into those same programs and same uses as the original tobacco settlement, or can you just help me to understand if there are differences?
Representative Herr.
Madam Chair and Representative New Brindley, we do have a testifier here that could actually speak to specific to this, but what I can say is that in the bill, it specifically states what the tobacco prevention account, establishing this account, what it will actually, the appropriations for the youth prevention account and what it will be used for. So it talks about, you know, electronic delivery, youth prevention. So if you look at 3.24 through 3.32, it kind of gives you, and actually to 4.4 as well, how some of these, how these funds will get used. Is that what you're asking for?
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess thank you for your clarifying question because it leads me to a slightly maybe different question. Is it necessary to establish a new tobacco prevention account, or can we not just place these funds or legislate placing these funds in the existing settlement account?
Representative Herr.
Chair Liebling, Representative New Brindley, from what I understand is that we had to establish this new. We couldn't use the existing tobacco.
Okay. And I'm going to call on our fiscal staff here, and please, if you would just please state your name, because he's sitting in for Mr. Harney, and thank you for doing that. So please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Brad Hegmer with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. There isn't a currently established account for the tobacco money, but this would create a new account for any future potential uses such as Juul or any other scenarios like that. And the author did specify the purposes that it can be used for on the end of page 3.
Okay. Representative Herr, is anything further on that? Or Representative New Brindley, any follow-up?
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Other questions or comments? All right. I'm not seeing any. So Representative Herr, any closing comment?
I just thank you for hearing the bill, and it is really important for us to prepare. The lawsuit will begin in a couple of weeks, and we'll know more on the status of that. But if there's a settlement, we will need the account sooner than later. And so appreciate the committee's consideration of this.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And in previous years, I know we've had some pretty interesting hearings where we've seen some of those devices that kids are using to inhale to vape, and it is pretty shocking, honestly, for those of us who don't have teens and don't necessarily come in contact with this, to really see how insidious this became. So hopefully we won't make the same mistake of the past, and if we get a settlement, we can actually use it to address the problem for which we got the funds. So thank you very much. So with that, House File 2422 is laid over for possible inclusion. House File 2041. Chair Gomez, is she here? Oh, there she is. Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So let's see. So the chair will move that House File 2041 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. So let's see. There is an author's amendment, I understand. And Chair Gomez, did you want to have us adopt that right now? I think you did, right?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right, so I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to have it discussed. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, everyone, for having me. House File 2041 contains a few different provisions associated with syringe service providers and sort of generally with harm reduction. The sections that I think are of particular interest to your committee, Madam Chair, are sections 2, 3, and 4. So this, the bill does, basically what it does is it removes these items, it removes the definition of a drug paraphernalia crime. That's the main thing that it does. It also, though, within this bill, defines syringe service providers. It goes through section 3 has a list. That's what we just added, the A1 amendment to section 3, which provides kind of a list of people who are exempt from some of these limitations on possessing hypodermic syringes or needles. It adds syringe service providers and their client, and also the A1 adds their clients. Section 2 provides us or defines a syringe service provider. Section 3 adds to the list of people who can possess or distribute hypodermic syringes and needles. And then Section 4 removes the limit of 10 or fewer for sales of unused hypodermic needles or syringes without a prescription. And what we're hearing is from areas, especially in greater Minnesota, where they don't have as many syringe service providers or people don't have as regular access to syringes that they might get at pharmacies, having a limitation to the possession limit, to the number of needles that you're able to possess. It just puts people in a position where they're not using clean supplies if they are injecting drugs. So just in general, when people have access to clean use supplies, if they're an intravenous drug user, it decreases infections and disease and death. And we have experienced in the last couple of years an HIV outbreak among intravenous drug users in the unsheltered homeless community. So this is sort of designed to meet that need, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Gomez. And so is there anyone else? Did you have any other testifiers?
I just, out of respect for the committee's time, I decided I'd just come up here solo. Okay. If anybody has any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Perfectly fine. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay. And I'm going to go to members in a second, but I just want to say, again, this is one of these things that, unfortunately, this session, we haven't had a lot of time to kind of get background on things. And so the the public health harm reduction strategy, we really haven't had a lot of background on it. But this is, I think part of that and part of the bill, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Gomez, but part of this was actually a public coming from the health department as well. The part about the syringe providers, I think, is also in the governor's budget, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Madam Chair. The bill comes from the kind of community of harm reduction experts, you know, that we have here in Minnesota, who just seem to make sure that people who are using drugs are also safe and are not in danger of dying. And then, you know, this has been a body of work, as you mentioned, that our Department of Health has been leading on. And so, you know, when they learned about this bill, then we kind of merged the two efforts. And to your point about background material, there is actually a bunch of good sort of in your packets. A lot of it's from the CDC. So it's just sort of general information about kind of the research behind harm reduction and this sort of effort. And it is an evidence-based practice that saves lives and improves health. And so, you know, I appreciate the consideration.
Yeah, thank you for that. And so over the years, we've seen a change from thinking of addiction and people who are addicted changing from their evil criminals to recognition that this is a health issue, and that it's a health issue that any of us or our kids or our relatives could suffer from. Nobody is immune, and so there's a change in thinking, which I really salute, to, you know, how do we keep people healthy, keep them alive and as healthy as possible while attempting to address the addiction instead of being like, oh, you're addicted, you're on your own, we don't care kind of attitude. So thank you for bringing the bill. I have Representative Quam and Representative Bierman. So Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the author. This isn't new. In fact, I think there are locations in Europe that have been around for a real long time. Understanding that what unintended consequences or negative issues have popped up in different locations, and how have we incorporated that information and learning to implement with this bill to prevent the negative aspects from presenting here and augment and promote the positive aspects of the bill.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. So, yeah, you're right. There are many places around the world where this has been the approach to substance use disorder at this point for many decades. And unfortunately, like in the U.S., we're catching up with Canada, with Europe. You know, in a lot of those places, they actually have what they call safe supply, so that you're not even you're when you talk about the externalities of decisions, I guess I can just say that the externalities of having people, you know, in our community who are experiencing really severe addiction and don't have access to, you know, safe use supplies, who don't have access to those supports that will help them get their lives back. Because the whole idea with harm reduction, right, is if any of us have had a loved one, especially who is addicted to opiates, and unfortunately many of us have, is like you need to keep them alive long enough in order for them to get the help that they need to make a permanent change in their lives. So that's what this is an attempt to do. As to the negative externalities of harm reduction policies around the world, I'm not familiar with a lot of evidence that shows negatives. What we do know is that even things like, you know, I guess I live in South Minneapolis. We have a lot of people who are impacted by addiction, and even something like, you know, I'm reading through this research, places where there are syringe service providers, there isn't the needle litter on the ground. It not only keeps the individuals who are injecting drugs safer, it keeps the surrounding community safer. Having syringe service providers don't just provide syringes, they provide a kind of line into social services for people who are experiencing substance use disorder. And so establishing those relationships actually between the individual and the provider over time is of incalculable benefit. So, you know, I'm not sure if you were familiar with some specific negatives that you'd seen in research from elsewhere in the world, but, you know, I guess I mostly know about the cascading positive impacts that can happen when we, you know, treat human beings who are, you know, suffering from addiction as humans and with compassion and care.
All right, thank you. Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Just, Madam Chair, that when we implement something new to Minnesota, we should plagiarize and really look at the implementations around and make sure that we avoid some oopses if we try to implement something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. So I have Representative Bierman, Nadeau, and New Brindley. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gomez, for bringing the bill forward. And I appreciate all the talk about looking at studies from around the world, what other countries are doing, because we in this country can learn a lot by looking at the rest of the world and some of the health policies that they have. There's no one magic bullet for a policy or a bill or a treatment for the opioid fentanyl crisis that we are in the throes of still in its third wave or maybe more. So this bill helps, as you stated, Rep. Gomez, to decrease infection, disease, and death, which, you know, we're learning from our health department. So education and treatment and listening to our public health sources that can tell us how to act, that's what we are should be doing. That's what we're doing here, and I thank you for bringing the bill forward.
All right. Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Gomez. My county has been working on this issue hard for a long time. So I think that this is, you know, obviously, you know, helpful, moving in the right direction. My question has to do with the repealer. As I was looking at this, it says that we're repealing possession of drug paraphernalia. We're repealing the prohibition. And the definition of drug paraphernalia in section in statute 152 is pretty big. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking that all we were going to do is we were going to repeal the syringe, the fact that, you know, we couldn't walk around with a bunch of syringes would no longer be, it would no longer be a crime that you could, you know, you could get charged with that. But that's already excluded in one, it's already excluded in that section. So are we, why we're repealing that section? I mean, there's a lot of things, drug paraphernalia, that probably are criminal in intent. And we want to be able, maybe law enforcement wants to be able to, again, I don't know how to make meth or anything, but this seems like a big repeal when the syringe is already exempted.
And Representative Nadeau, I will let Representative Gomez answer, but just so you know, this is going to public safety. So that is maybe a question more in the jurisdiction of the Public Safety Committee. But Chair Gomez, go ahead, and if you want to address
that. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's kind of what I was going to say. I think that I focused in my comments here on the sections that I thought were particularly relevant to the Health Committee, knowing that it's being referred to public safety and that those are, you know, that issue around repealing the definition of a drug paraphernalia crime is, I believe, the main topic that we're going to discuss when this moves to public safety. I guess I'll just say briefly, you know, what I've heard from people who I know in my community, in our community, in Hennepin County, who work with people with substance use disorder, is something that I didn't know about, is that encouraging people to use smoking supplies instead of shooting a drug up is a harm reduction effort. And so the idea that we would criminalize people who are struggling with substance use disorder and are making efforts to kind of move to safer consumption patterns is a problem for me, because I don't think that criminalizing people who are addicted works. I think that that's sort of the fundamental thing, is that my belief and the reason that I'm bringing this bill forward is because I believe that drug paraphernalia possession crimes are not a way of catching your fentanyl trafficker. They're not a way of catching and holding accountable somebody who has a position in the kind of drug distribution world where you would want them to be criminalized, to have a felony, which means they can't get an apartment and it's hard for them to getting a job. The people who are walking around on our streets with drug paraphernalia, those are people who unfortunately are in the difficult position of being addicted to a deadly and dangerous substance, and they need a public health intervention, and they need assistance, and they don't need to go to jail. And so that's why I'm bringing it forward. And as I said, we'll have a more complete discussion
about
in public.
And members, I hope we can not have that discussion here. And I will commit to you that if this goes in our omnibus bill, that piece will not go in our omnibus bill. So that is really not in the jurisdiction of this committee. Anything further, Representative Nadeau?
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for that. I mean, we're in agreement, and I know it's not in the purview of this committee, but I don't think there's a ton of crimes that are committed that where they're charged where it's just drug paraphernalia possession. But I'm with you, and I will hopefully be able to watch the next committee hearing to see how this discussion comes out. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomez. And, Madam Chair, I appreciate your willingness to have that conversation, because while it's not really under the purview of this committee, we're voting on this today, and it includes that language, and that language matters for me. So I really appreciate your example or your explanation. And frankly, Chair Gomez, I just want to thank you for your bill presentation. It was really thorough, and you told us what your bill does, and I really, really appreciate that. I also just want to say that given your explanation to Representative Nadeau's question, I appreciate that as well. That was my only hesitation, because I think that ultimately this language, this bill is about hope for people who are really struggling, and it's about understanding that there's always a chance to get better, and I think that that's what this is about. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Representative New Brindley. And so before I give the final word here to Chair Gomez, I just would say that it's been a really a great thing over the last, I don't know how many years here in the legislature, that the issue of addressing addiction has been a very bipartisan issue. And I guess on an unfortunate level, it's probably because the problem of addiction is very bipartisan. It is not a respecter of anyone. And some members who've been in the body who are not here any longer, who were on all sides politically, have been touched by this. And so it's really there are things for anyone who thinks that we don't work together on anything, they should look again, because there certainly are issues that unite us. Unfortunately, this is a very tragic one, but thank you for your comments, members. Chair Gomez, final word?
Just my thanks to the committee for the consideration, and to Chair Liebling for providing some of that context of what I think is, a public policy approach that is less punitive and more humane, and that's what we should be going for. And so I appreciate that context that you added also.
All right. Thank you, members.
With
that, I will renew my motion that House File 2041 it's the original bill as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, Chair Gomez. Okay. House File 1487, Representative Ryer. And Representative Ryer's motion is that House File 1487 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. And I also should probably just explain that this bill has been heard in taxes, am I right? And it will be carried in the tax bill. So, but it is just getting hearing here because it relates to our area of jurisdiction as well. So the motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion. So. Representative Ryer, I don't think there's an amendment to this one, is there? Okay, so welcome, and please go ahead and present 1487.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1487 is a bill focused on consumer rights and the appropriate use of government services. This bill limits the use of state resources by private companies, removing the option for collecting medical debt by garnishing individuals' tax returns. At present, some private nonprofit hospitals specifically those that lease their buildings from their city or county, are allowed to submit claims to the State of Minnesota Department of Revenue. The department diverts the person's tax return to that hospital to cover medical debt. Ambulance services are also covered by this program. The Department of Revenue receives $15 per claim, adding up to about $272,000 per year to the general fund. Bottom line, our state budget is being enriched at the expense of Minnesotans who are struggling financially. The program was set up as an expedient way to get money to hospitals when the uninsured rate was much higher. Many more people were using ERs for routine care, and uncompensated care was at a crisis level. It was expanded to ambulance services to address unsustainably low reimbursements. There are a number of problems with this. First, I don't think the government system should be used to collect non-government debt. This is an inappropriate use of our resources. Second, there are few safeguards and consumer protections. For example, there's no verification by the Department of Revenue about the accuracy of the claim. Finally, and most importantly, this program harms the people who can least afford it, lower-income working people. This is a hard place to be in our society. Many work multiple jobs to scrape by and earn just a bit too much to qualify for public health care programs. More than 750,000 Minnesotans have medical debt in collections. Too many end up in bankruptcy. Their tax returns are an annual chance to get ahead, pay some bills, or take care of pressing home maintenance. This is a crushing blow and often comes as an unwelcome surprise. At the same time, hospitals and ambulances are necessary and do not come to us free. Yet the healthcare system is not set up in a way that truly covers the cost of providing services. As a state, we must take on these structural problems, and in the meantime, we need to get the burden off the backs of the people in our state. Now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to share more about the bill and its benefits. Thank you. I'll look forward to your questions and ask for your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. And are you Kim Miller? All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. My name is Kim Miller, and I am a certified financial counselor with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. LSS Financial Counseling has over 30 years of experience supporting thousands of people in Minnesota and nationwide. We have offices in Brainerd, Duluth, Virginia, Wilmer, St. Cloud, Mankato, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. We also partner with LSS Youth Services in Rochester. I am here in support of House File 1487, aimed to stop the practice of revenue recapture for medical debt. I have worked with many people to create plans to pay off their debt, and oftentimes it includes medical debt, so I'm very familiar with how debts and debt collection practices can affect one's financial stability. My colleagues and I help Minnesotans gain confidence and feel more prepared to handle emergencies in the future, but the revenue recapture process undermines that confidence and preparation. Revenue recapture creates undue hardship by bypassing normal debt collection practices. For instance, under standard collection practices, families would be protected from garnishments of wages or bank accounts if they have received income-based public benefits in the last 6 months. Also, original creditors cannot escalate collection practices if the payment plan is being followed. Families making less than $40,000 a year account for over two-thirds of revenue recapture claims for medical debt. These families are especially in need of guardrails to protect them against overly aggressive or destabilizing methods of debt collection because they are already financially precarious. Revenue recapture has no such guardrails. Healthcare companies can refer patient debt to revenue recapture without any court process, and there are no protections in place for recipients of public benefits. Payment plans can also be revoked and may not even be offered in good faith because of revenue recapture. For example, one of our counselors worked with a client who had an affordable payment arrangement with a small hospital that ended up merging with a large hospital system. The new billing office wanted a higher payment that was nine times more and threatened revenue recapture if the client did not agree. So we're just wanting to ensure healthcare companies will be required to follow the same regulations as other debt collectors and any aggressive tools such as revenue recapture. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I have Claudia Holt. Well, Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and members of the committee. My name is Claudia Holt, Programs and Strategy Director at Prepare and Prosper here in St. Paul. For over 50 years, Prepare and Prosper has provided free quality tax preparation, financial services, coaching, and bank accounts to low and moderate income individuals and families here in Minnesota. At Prepare and Prosper, we think of tax time as the money moment. For many families, a tax refund is the largest portion of income they'll receive all year, sometimes accounting for up to 40% of their total annual income. By subjecting families to revenue recapture practices, we strip them of their ability to make good choices about their financial futures using their tax refunds. For families who live paycheck to paycheck, this money can make or break their financial stability for the coming year. According to Pew Research, 70% of households in the U.S. are constrained by income, have limited savings, and/or are challenged by debt. A tax refund can present an opportunity to catch up on bills, pay down debt, handle deferred expenses, or establish important emergency savings. In a 2021 survey, 53% of folks with annual incomes under $30,000 said they plan to use some of their refund to cover day-to-day expenses. 27 said they plan to put some of it into savings. The ability to catch up on bills and save for the future helps people weather financial setbacks and is essential to building generational wealth. Tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit and Working Family Credit are the largest anti-poverty tools in the U.S., but those credits cannot do their job if the refund never hits the person's bank accounts. These tax credits are intended to help protect our most economically vulnerable, and people work hard throughout the year to earn them. They should be subjected to the same protections as a person's wages. Revenue recapture is especially harmful in the case of medical debt, which is nearly always unchosen, often unforeseen, and can quickly add up to thousands of dollars, especially for someone with high deductible health insurance. Just last month, I met a single mother at a tax clinic who was worried that any refund she might be eligible for would be recaptured. She was behind on her January rent and was counting on using her tax refund to catch up so she wouldn't be evicted. Without that tax refund, her options for keeping her apartment would be limited. While she was working to slowly pay down her debt, paying her rent needed to be a priority. A refund should not be thought of as extra money or a windfall. It is the workers' own earnings they deserve to get back. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in favor of this legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Anna Odegaard. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pardon me. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I am the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. The Asset Building Coalition is a coalition of nonprofit organizations committed to ensuring equitable asset building opportunities for low-income and BIPOC communities across our state. Pardon me, I have a frog in my throat. I'd like to thank Representative Ryer for taking the lead on this bill, Chair Liebling for her commitment to this work, and all our wonderful co-authors, too numerous to name here. In 2019, one of my member organizations shared with our advisory council that a client of his had incurred significant hospital debt from a health crisis, had set up a payment plan with the hospital, and was current on her payments. She was shocked, therefore, when her entire tax refund was seized through revenue recapture to pay her hospital debt. I was shocked because I know the agreement between Minnesota hospitals and the Attorney General's office prohibits hospitals from referring patient debt to collections if payments are being made on a payment plan. A little research revealed that the agreement with the AG, intended to protect patients from overly aggressive medical debt collections, doesn't apply to the revenue recapture process. A health crisis is expensive for most families, whether they're uninsured or have an insurance plan with a high deductible. And it can be expensive not only in medical bills, but often also in lost wages. The AG agreement and other statutory protections regulating third-party debt collection are intended to protect these families. And we object to revenue recapture specifically because it circumvents those protections and causes harm to financially vulnerable families. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone, so we'll go to member discussion. So we have Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My big concern
on this you might need to speak into the mic a little more.
Yeah, I think the mics in this room are just dead on this side of the room. This speak up louder. So my big concern on this is that going through this process, the hospitals can, you know, basically charge whatever they want. The patient who may be entitled to the cash prices that hospitals offer to indigent patients, people without insurance. There's no guarantee that that's the price that they're going to offer. If a hospital could put the full list price on the invoice, no questions asked, and the patient has completely lost any bargaining power that they might have with the hospital or ambulance company to negotiate a better price or term. So it's the hospitals are getting, you know, whatever they ask and no questions asked. It's just not fair.
Any comment, Representative Ryer, on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I think that's a fair point. I think the need for this program is more fundamental than that, regardless of what pay reimbursement levels, whatever the patient's being charged. It's still a process that is going to be very hard on people.
Representative Nadeau, and then New Brindley, and then Murphy. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I normally love your bills, and not that I don't love this one yet. Don't get me wrong. Nobody supports overcollection of debt, especially medical debt. And to Representative Elkins, you know, thoughtful comments too. I mean, if I thought that was, you know, predominant way that hospitals did business, which I don't think they do. I mean, I think they, and we're going to hear another bill that you've got coming up that we're going to be able to talk about this a little bit more. But my question in this bill specifically is you're carving out the University of Minnesota. So University of Minnesota, are they able to use revenue recapture to go after and get paid when we're preventing, for example, you know, another hospital from being able to do it if they're a nonprofit?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way the change to the statute is set up, it does just exclude the private nonprofit hospitals that lease property from a city or county. We are not proposing to take away the right for revenue recapture from any public organization, but I would point out that nonprofits that are not owned by a public, that don't have the property that they lease, can't use this. Some hospitals in the state can use it, some cannot. So you could argue, of course, that there's a competitive issue there. I would argue that the fact that they lease a building shouldn't be sufficient reason that they would be able to use the strength of the state to do their bill collection.
Representative Nadeau?
And thank you for that. You know, I also know that this is not a huge revenue generator. It's not used very often, and when it is, they're able to capture small amounts. But I do think that I agree with where we're trying to go. You know, I also think we have to respect the fact that I get, and we've heard testimony here today, that there's people that can't pay their medical bills. I mean, when I was younger, I couldn't pay my medical bills, and for years I paid those medical bills. And that's what people do in some cases, and some people can't. Would I wish that I would have been forgiven? Maybe. I don't really know. But, you know, when there's a transaction that occurs and I go in to get a service, I'm expected to pay for said service. I want the hospital to deliver that service as low as they possibly can. But you know what? When I needed that service, they were there to provide it. And I think that there's a responsibility on us to try to ensure that we pay those bills. And we're going to talk about charity care coming up, and we're going to talk about other programs coming up. But this right here, taking a tool off the table for some people, for some organizations, some hospitals, in order to be repaid for the services that they provided, regardless. If a person can't pay, I get it. There's some people that just don't want to pay. Now they can't even use this tool to do that. And it applies to some, it doesn't apply to all. I just don't think this is fair. I don't think this is a fair treatment of the hospitals that have made a commitment to this state and the people in this state to deliver these services. So I'm not there yet. Maybe I will be. But thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I'm going to let Representative Ryer respond, but I just do want to make it sure that everyone understands. Hospitals, these organizations can still collect debt through the normal channels. All the bill is doing is taking away this sort of special procedure that is available to government, and we could debate whether government generally should give it up. That would be a different bill. But this bill is not taking away tools to collect, you know, it's taking away this specific tool. So, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I look forward to hearings in this committee because I know we'll have a dialogue, and I think that's a good thing. Two things about it. One, you may have noticed in my testimony that the state charges $15 to these hospitals for a claim. When they use, and other hospitals and other businesses and organizations use, a private debt collector, they're not paying $15. And again, I'd go, this is not fair as a business practice. It's a bad business practice that we are allowing that. It just makes no sense to me. It was a compromise that was reached a long time ago when these hospitals in particular were in greater isolation and need. The system was different. Uninsurance was higher. Charitable care was much higher. There were all sorts of financial reasons that our predecessors chose to put this into place that are different now. And so I continue to think that it is just not appropriate. Why would our state be doing this? There are other organizations that provide life-saving services to people who may not get repaid, but we don't say our Department of Revenue is going to help you collect that money, and we're not even going to look at the bills. I think you heard that when bill collectors do it, there are protections for people. But how many times have you gotten a medical bill and found that there was just something completely out of line, unreasonable, not through any malice on the part of the healthcare system, I want to make sure that that's perfectly clear, or on the part of the people, because I know how hard people work in these systems. But mistakes happen. Thousands and thousands of dollars of overcharges happen. And no one looks at it. It's not part of the process to say, is this claim right? And yet still, it's being just like, oh, okay, here's your $15, please get this for me. There are just so many flaws. The argument has been made before, well, do we want to have private debt collectors doing this and harming people's credit? Medical debt is no longer being reported on credit reports. So why not say you can collect unpaid debt, but we're not going to do it for you? For you, narrowly defined specific set of hospitals and medical services, ambulance services.
Okay, I have Representative New Brindley. I think I'll go to Representative New Brindley and then Murphy. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Ryer. I think that we all understand what you're trying to do with this bill. And that is a positive thing. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. So I guess my question is, so this still allows a city that is presenting a claim for a municipal hospital to use revenue recapture. It allows other state agencies to use revenue recapture. So I guess number one, do you know how often this is used for other agencies, for nonprofit hospitals? Do you know what that balance is and how often revenue recapture is used for these things? I mean, I assume that it would be used as often as it could for the hospitals. I just don't know how that functions with state agencies.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. New Brindley. I think Ms. Odegaard would have these numbers at more at hand.
Okay, Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley. I can share actual data with you that the Department of Revenue provided, but to give you just kind of a ballpark, last year about $250 million worth of medical debt was referred to the revenue recapture process. Only about $7 million worth of ambulance debt. Those are the two categories that would be eliminated here. But only about 12, I think it's 12 or 13 hospitals in Minnesota that are not the municipal hospitals still use this process. So in terms of the overall revenue recapture process that includes, you know, court debt and debt to other agencies and UI overpayments, I mean, there are many categories. This is, it would be a relatively small proportion of the revenue recapture program altogether.
Oh, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. That is helpful. So that's a little bit of my concern. So this actually is only going to apply to a relatively small amount of the revenue recapture total. And so I guess my question is, if the revenue recapture is a problem, it's a problem. And I think, you know, I can see an argument being made for, well, they're state agencies, this is money owed to the state, and therefore we should be able to use revenue recapture for those things, which would be all of the other revenue recapture, theoretically, right? But it seems like there is also a public interest in ensuring that hospitals are financially stable. And I assume, I don't know why this was instituted initially, but I assume that there was a public interest in that. And it seems that there is a public interest in making sure that our hospitals are financially stable. So I guess my only other question is, you know, we've heard the words poor and indigent, right? That this is potentially harmful for the poor and indigent. However, does this only apply to the poor and indigent, or does this apply to any revenue recapture regardless of the patient and their resources?
Ms. Odegaard?
Madam Chair, thank you, and Representative New Brindley, thank you. We have had a number of discussions with stakeholders about whether an income cap for the prohibition on revenue recapture might be appropriate. What was determined was that we are not confident that there is an effective process. We know that the Department of Revenue does not do any kind of verification of household income before they process a revenue recapture claim. The hospitals are often their policy recommends that they, or their policy states that they need to assess ability to pay before using revenue recapture. But what we know and what the hospitals have shared is that they often take patient claims where they are not able to reach that patient. So they really do not have any idea. They don't have any data about what their household income is and send those to revenue recapture. So we have aggregate numbers that show that about 2/3 of the claims sent to revenue recapture are to households with income below $40,000 a year. So that's what we would call low-income households. So 1/3 of them are above that. But in terms of the hospitals ascertaining which claims are which, that's a pretty complicated process. And so we decided that the simpler solution was just to say hospitals need to use the regular debt collection process, which already has a number of guardrails, both in statute and in that AG agreement, rather than doing this kind of runaround this with the revenue recapture process.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that explanation. However, I struggle with that a little bit because, you know, you say the Department of Revenue doesn't verify income, but this is based on a tax return. A tax return is establishing your taxable income. Like, it seems like there would be a way to very quickly say your gross taxable income is X dollars, then this would apply to you, or if it's below that, it would not apply to you. So perhaps that would not be on the hospitals to figure that out, but it seems like even though the Department of Revenue, it seems like it would be an easier fix than we're trying to put forward, because of course these are being taken from a tax return. So of course, we have just told the state what our taxable income is. So that just seems a little odd to me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, I think we should go to Representative Murphy and And then if there's a response to that, maybe in the closing comment. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. My concern from a rural standpoint is I know from talking to the ambulance companies in my area that they're in a big time hurt. I also know from them that they really work with people. They want to operate this plan that you talked about. You know, that's really important to them. And there is a fair level of forgiveness, but it takes away one of the tools that they have at the end of the day. And hospitals in rural Minnesota are struggling badly too. But I just see this as being a concern, you know, especially when we're starting to pick the winners and the losers a little bit. Who's going to be penalized from it? Who's not? That doesn't seem fair to me either. But I just know from doing business up there, and these businesses are in business, stay in business, so that they can provide just the services that we're talking about. And as a business person, it's a last resort always. But you need to stay in business, and so some of these things are really important. So this is a tool. It's the last one on the list, I'm sure, and they are really working hard to operate these payment plans like you talk about, and I think those are really important. I'm a little disappointed that in the bill there's not something that helps with that kind of language. It seems like it's you know, it's negative towards small businesses, hospitals, ambulance companies, and it's really just in favor of the consumer. But it is on both sides. We need these businesses to stay in business, too. Otherwise, we won't be in a position to help them. So anyway, I just wanted to consider those things, too. But thank you. I think it's fine to be looking out for people. And we just want to make sure that nobody's left out, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. So final word on the bill, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, all of you who have provided feedback, and those who I've talked to in the past. A couple of things. One, I think that the existence of the program at a macro level, as Representative Brindley's talked about, why do we have it at all? I think you were saying that. How come just this? Okay. Never mind. I won't. I strike that from the record. I heard someone mention, why do we even have this? Oh, Chair Liebling, how could I get you too confused?
You know, that sharp, strong women. That's right.
There you go. Having the program in and of itself selects winners and losers. There are struggling nonprofit hospitals out there, no doubt, who are not eligible to use this. Not municipal, not with the lease or rental agreement. They're set at a disadvantage. Second, I do have. Share your deep concern about the ambulance system. The fact of the matter is most of the ambulance claims are going to, say, Mayo, North Memorial, large players in the system. I know there are some that go to smaller ambulance services. I'm worried at a structural level, and I hope that we are going to solve the chronic underfunding of that system. So I am completely there for that. As far as this goes, the reference to some of the amounts being small or it's not that big a piece of the pie, when you're that person, it's a big piece of the pie. And this is a place where I think it's appropriate for us to think about the needs of the consumer, of the patient, and their family. Because we're hurting employers and employees in Minnesota that way, too.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. With that, House File 1487 is laid over for possible inclusion. And we will go right into your next bill, which is House File 2599. And so Representative Ryer is moving that House File 2599 be recommended to be placed on the general register. So there is an author's amendment to this bill, I understand, to put the bill in the shape in which Representative Ryer would want to discuss that. And Representative Ryer, is that the A2? I see there are a couple of different amendments.
Yes, Madam Chair, the A2 amendment.
All right, so. Okay, so the A1, I guess, was supposed to be taken out. It was a prior iteration. So
that's right.
Representative Ryer is moving the A2 amendment to get the bill in the proper shape in which she'd like to discuss it. All in favor of adoption of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A2 is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we've been talking today about medical debt and the challenges it provides to patients and families, as well as to hospitals. Yet in many cases, patients may be eligible for financial assistance, but not realize it's available to them. House File 2599 addresses this by establishing requirements for hospitals to screen patients for eligibility for health coverage or assistance. The bill outlines the steps that hospitals need to take. For patients who are uninsured or whose coverage status is unknown, they must screen for eligible likely eligibility for charity care, for state or federal coverage, or premium tax credits. And then they must help patients with applying for assistance or give them a referral to navigators or other support. It also requires hospitals to determine whether a patient is eligible for financial assistance prior to taking certain actions to collect debt, such as referring the debt to a third-party debt collector or pursuing wage garnishments. And then finally, it asks hospitals to certify that they have complied with all provisions required by the Attorney General Agreement related to debt collection prior to referring a patient account for collections. We've had good partnership in the process of developing this bill. Refinements have been included during the drafting based on feedback from DHS and from hospitals. We continue to work with the Minnesota Hospital Association, who does not oppose it. Their members are keen on making this work as well as possible, given the public health emergency and the Medicaid transition, and their desire to have as many people on coverage as possible. Now I'd like to turn it over to a testifier to share more about the bill and its benefits. Thank you.
All right. Welcome back. Please introduce yourself again.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, my name is Kim Miller, and I'm a certified financial counselor with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. I am here in support of House File 2599, aimed to screen patients for public health care coverage and other financial assistance prior to proceeding with payment plans, debt collection, denial of care, or credit product. In my work, I see how medical bills affect our clients' finances on a regular basis. Attempts to make payments on unaffordable medical bills can create crises that lead to an overall destabilization of their financial situation. Assisting eligible patients with enrollment of public health care programs or discounted care helps families avoid the financial stress of medical debt that would have otherwise been covered by other programs or assistance. My job includes working with people directly, as well as providing financial train-the-trainer workshops to frontline workers who support low-income families. A common barrier I hear about is filling out and managing paperwork. There are barriers with language, reading, writing, as well as overall capacity to manage documents. In stressful times, especially with medical needs, extra support makes it possible to complete the screening process. Medical assistance programs can backdate bills up to 3 months, so doing this in a timely manner is helpful in reducing medical debt. For example, I had a client with a $600 medical bill that would have been covered by our hospital's financial assistance program, which includes an affordable repayment plan, or which would have included a plan by the client, but the deadline had passed to apply. Her situation that led to this medical treatment directly contributed to her being unable to complete the application. As a result, the bill went to collections and the hospital did not receive any payment. Another barrier is asking for help. It's really hard to do. Offering screen assistance directly as part of the process reduces the stigma and feelings of shame that may stop someone from accessing resources available to them. Shame affects people of all income levels, and I have heard the relief in people's voice when they tell me, "Oh, thanks for not judging me and providing options instead." Informing patients they qualify for assistance programs and normalizing the use of them right away can increase access to health care and reduce the burden of medical debt. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Also, Anna Odegaard is back. Welcome. Please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. You have heard from Representative Ryer that over 750,000 Minnesotans have unpaid medical debt, or 17% of Minnesota adults. I want to emphasize that this number only captures part of the problem. It does not capture medical debt that's being paid over time on a payment plan, loans from a bank or other lender, or loans from family and friends taken on to pay medical debt. Worst of all,
credit card debt taken on to pay medical bills. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that when they included these, which they call medical debt disguised as another kind of debt, over 40% of American adults have medical debt. The statistic was not news to the Asset Building Coalition members because we work with families every day struggling with this hardship, trying to decide which bills to pay and which to skip this month so they can still put food on the table. The goal of this bill is to reduce the number of Minnesotans that take on medical debt despite being eligible for public health care coverage or hospital financial assistance that would have covered some or all of the cost of their health care. I urge you to take a look at the article from the Rochester Post Bulletin included in your committee packets with a catchy but ultimately discouraging headline, Charity Care? They found it on TikTok. People who have been lucky enough not to struggle with unaffordable medical bills may not fully understand the barriers people face that Kim was just talking about in the midst of a health crisis, accessing the assistance that they're eligible for, or even knowing what help is available. We can't rely on TikTok to help Minnesotans understand their options. I'm so grateful to the Minnesota Hospital Association for working with us on this bill to make sure their patients receive the assistance they're eligible for, and of course to Representative Ryer and Chair Liebling for their commitment to both the health and the financial well-being of all Minnesotans.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Okay, no one else wants to testify. Okay, I'm a little bit surprised we don't have any representatives of hospitals who want to testify on the bill, but we'll go to member questions and comments. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since this would have hospitals doing much of the work and function of navigators, would the hospitals be able to and qualify to get the navigator fees?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. That's one of the things we've worked on the hospitals with, to not put the responsibility for them to accomplish all of that. We say they may. Maybe they have someone who's doing that, but otherwise they can refer people to a navigator who then does that work. And they don't make the appointment to refer them to the navigator. They say, here's the information you need.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm looking at is much of the functions, except for the final activity, would be added to hospitals. So if you're adding personnel training and adding functions, and if you do the final step, then you ought to be able to get the navigator fees. And that's what I'm trying to clarify is if the hospital is doing all this stuff and they do that last little bit, would they qualify and receive the navigator fees?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Quam. That has not come up as a concern or question from the hospitals themselves, so I would just take that back and think about that.
Madam Chair, when we're doing a bill like this, I would think, well, it came up in committee discussion, so I would think that we would prudently look at that because, you know, nonprofit hospitals aren't evil. They're just in a financial crunch, and if we're adding mandates and additional activity, we should have that option to where they would also be able to get the funding, you know, for doing the work, since they're, you know, this isn't having them do it. So I would hope that the author would look at the option of hospitals fulfilling this activity, because it's sort of with the intent of your amendment broadening, you know, or certified application counselor and et cetera. So I would think a small amendment would clear that up and offer that option if they wish to do it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. And this might be a good moment for me to tell members that we're going to change our motion and lay the bill over. So that will, of course, provide a little more opportunity for additional conversation and adjustment if necessary. I just want to let folks know we've got Nadeau, Bonner, Fisher, Schumacher, and New Brindley. So maybe we should just hold further comment on that. Okay, Representative Ryer.
Just one brief comment. After your first question, Representative Quam, I did say that I would look at that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to be super fast. My my question is on Section 3, Representative Ryer. Most of this bill, I believe that at least the hospitals that I'm familiar with are already doing a lot of this work now. But in Section 3, starting at line 5.8, I'm concerned about this paragraph that that an amount can't exceed the total amount a provider would be reimbursed for that service or treatment from its most favored insurer. That seems a little, it's confusing to me. You know, payers have, you know, they have different plans, they have different co-pays, they have different deductibles, they have different co-insurance. That seems really confusing to me. Can you shed some light and bring clarity for me on that?
Representative Ryer or Ms. Odegaard?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau. This language is taken from the Attorney General's agreement with the hospitals. So the hospitals have actually already agreed to this provision. We wanted to put it into statute so that it was more enforceable, so that the Department of Health would have enforcement authority over it. But it is already a part of the agreement hospitals have made. So I think they do understand how this works.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So every hospital has already agreed to this language in a contract exactly like this with the Attorney General of the State of Minnesota. That's what your testimony is?
Ms. Odegaard?
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct. I would need to maybe check word for word, but that, yes, that's my understanding.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right, and I think you're talking about something that was negotiated by Attorney General Hatch quite a while ago. Yeah, I recall that. Okay, Representative Bonner, then Fisher, then Schumacher, then New Brindley. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer. You know, I'm a big fan of this particular bill. We just spoke about the pitfalls of hospitals getting paid for the services they render. This bill is literally providing a mechanism to make sure that hospitals get paid for the care they deliver. We know the pitfalls of what happens when someone is uninsured and can't pay the bill. That's money they're not getting. There's that expression. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, whatever. Realistically, if we know you're going to get paid, this is to the advantage of hospitals. Whether they get paid for a navigator or not, getting paid is the key underlying statement here, making sure that happens. And more importantly, you know, most hospitals are doing this already. We just want to make sure what's in statute that everybody's doing it. So this is the right thing to do. And quite frankly, this is good for patients. This is good for taxpayers. This is good for hospitals to make sure they get paid. This is just better for all. Thanks for that, and I appreciate the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is to the author of the bill. Thank you for bringing the bill forward, Representative Ryer. The one thing that I do want you to take a look going forward is the fact that hospital is defined as a private nonprofit. We do have for-profit hospitals that are in the state these days, and I do know that some of them that are out there are already doing charity care in some cases at a higher level than our supposed nonprofit hospitals. So if we could maybe look at expanding that out a little bit more, particularly with the way the healthcare industry has changed, we may see more and more for-profit hospitals coming in. If you could look at that part. And then to the chair, I don't know if this could be something for a future one, is for us to take a look at what are the different hospital systems doing in terms of charity care. I know the department has some of that information. I think it would be enlightening for the committee to maybe look at this as a future type of topic to see what's really going on, because I was kind of surprised when I saw for-profit hospitals having much more in charity care they were providing than nonprofit hospitals. So I you know, just out of curiosity, what's really going on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Fisher. And to that question, I would love to have a hearing on that very topic. Of course, we don't have time this session, but I know that the Department of Health has been working on that issue, and I'm not sure the degree to which information really is collected and available, but I think they are working on that. So thank you for bringing that up. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer. My first question is just quickly, the language references the Attorney General Hospital Agreement that we've heard about several times today. I did look on the committee page to see if that was included in our materials, because frankly, I'm not that technologically savvy. I tried Googling, I found a press release about it, but I couldn't find the agreement. And so I'm wondering if you can just run through, just quickly, what is in that Attorney General Hospital Agreement?
Ms. Odegaard?
Madam Chair, thank you. It's about 30 pages long, so it wouldn't be quick.
Yeah, that's definitely not what I thought.
I would need to get my computer from my chair and pull up my outline of that agreement. Would you like me to do that, or do you want me to follow up with you afterwards?
I think a follow-up would be more appropriate, Ms. Odegaard. We just don't have time for that in this hearing. Representative New Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that actually answers a little bit of my question, just knowing that it's a significant agreement. There is a lot to that agreement. So this puts some additional requirements in place. I'm really trying to wrap my head around this, because as Representative Nadeau indicated, I think most hospitals already do these things, and it's those patients who they're having a difficult time communicating with. Maybe on the part of the hospital, but often not. I mean, we talk a lot in this space. I mean, we're talking about the Medicaid renewal process. It's really difficult because they can't find these people. They're transient. They move a lot. They don't have current addresses. It's actually just really difficult to find people. And so I'm a little bit concerned about that from this perspective. And I would just add, you know, the Section 3 that Representative Nadeau referenced, it's just really hard for me to wrap my head around. You know, I've had conversations, I've talked about in this committee that, you know, I've certainly been one of these families that has had really high medical expenses. And I assure you, we made less than $125,000 a year. That's actually a lot of money. At least for me, it's a lot of money. $125,000 a year is a really nice income. And I'm concerned that I'm concerned that we're not being particularly realistic. It feels quite punitive. It feels quite punitive to a hospital in recouping some of their costs, especially when I see numbers like a household income of $125,000. I think I was making far less than that, and just one medication costs $600 a month. It certainly... That's frustrating to me, and it seems quite punitive. So that's my comment. And I guess the other thing I would say, I'm glad that these are both being laid over, Madam Chair. I appreciate that clarification, because it seems like if we do this, the other bill, the revenue recapture is probably not necessary. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Final word, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting because, well, there's a couple things on that Section 3. I think that there would be a much more problematic outcome for hospitals if we changed that to, say, $75,000 or $40,000 or any other amount, because then they would have two sets of rules that they had to be guided by, both the Attorney General. And if we changed the things that are designed to be consistent with the AG's agreement with them, which they negotiated together and came to agreement on, we would just confuse everything if we didn't align with that. Second, I think that hospitals, someone said hospitals aren't evil. I would never say anything than hospitals are out there taking care of all of us with good faith, and they are knocking themselves out. So I just needed to say that, because I think hospitals do their best, and each one does it their own way. They, you know, and they're reinventing the wheel. If we can provide direction on good steps, comprehensive steps they can follow, and note that patients can opt out of this. And if patients refuse to participate, the hospitals aren't held accountable for that. This has been designed to be very hospital focused. We have had many conversations, made many changes. The Minnesota Hospital Association made a point of texting me to say our members are keen on this. I'm quoting the text. So I just want to clear up any misconception that this is something that is being done to. My goal is that this is being done with in a way that helps hospitals get the money that they are entitled to for the services they provide in a way that is more beneficial to the patients, and that does in fact put revenue recapture out of business. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer, and thank you, Ms. Odegaard, and to the other testifier as well. And so with that, House File 2599, as amended, is laid over. Thank you. Next on the agenda is Representative Bierman, House File 1940. And the motion, Representative Bierman's motion, is for House File 1940 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I don't think we have an amendment to the bill. Is that correct, Representative Bierman?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So go ahead then and present House File 1940.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Today I'm requesting your support for House File 1940, a bill to promote quality and access to palliative care in Minnesota. Palliative care is a team-based medical care to manage pain, stress, and symptoms for people with serious or life-limiting illness and to support caregivers. It helps at any age and any stage of care. It reduces the frequency and cost of acute medical events and increases patient and family quality of life. Our state Palliative Care Advisory Council exists to advise us on ways to improve access to palliative care. Unfortunately, the council's effectiveness has been hindered by a lack of state funding. The council is set to expire in 2025, but this group's work must continue with our support to keep palliative care moving forward in Minnesota. House File 1940 does three important things to help this work continue. Number one, it eliminates the sunset date of the Minnesota Palliative Care Advisory Council. Second, it funds the council's work through the Department of Health at a cost of $44,000 per year. And number three, it launches a one-time DHS study on the fiscal, medical, and social impacts of creating a palliative care benefit for medical assistants and Minnesota Care enrollees at a cost of $150,000. Members, an impressive array of 24 local, state, and national organizations have endorsed House File 1940. And in your packet, you have a letter from the Minnesota Leadership Council on Aging as well. And I want to thank Representative Quam for signing on to the bill and Lead Schumacher for his support as well. So just hope you'll support the bill today. Thank you for your time. And I look forward to your questions. Madam Chair, no testifiers, so just moving on to thoughts and questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Bierman. Well, let me just ask, is there anyone in the public who would like to testify on the bill? I'm not seeing anyone, so we can go to any member discussion or questions. So I'm not seeing any member questions, but I think I have a question, Representative Bierman. So this is removing the sunset, and also it is doing the study to see if there should be a medical assistance benefit for palliative care. So could you give us a little bit more about if we remove the sunset? So I assume that looking at whether this should be a benefit, in fact, I think I read that that was part of the work of the council up to this point. Can you give us a little bit more of a sense going forward of what the work of the council would consist of, since that piece presumably would be off the table?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. And so the council, which is all voluntary, They work to, they assess access across the state. They connect and work with doctors because it's building awareness, too, of what palliative care is. And so they work with doctors who need to understand palliative care, many of them better than they do, so that they will direct people toward receiving palliative care, which helps people live longer and be healthier, not only them, but their families as well. So it is about access and advising. And then just to look at, you know, what does the state need to do to make sure more people are receiving this beneficial care and how we can implement it more holistically across the spectrum of our healthcare system.
Okay, thank you. So it's not all about medical assistance.
No, no, ma'am.
It, right.
Madam Chair, it is not all about medical assistance. It's about studying how to make this more widespread in the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your question, actually. That was helpful. If that's the case, and if what we're doing here, I'm just wondering why, I understand what you just said, but it seems like a repealer is a sunset is appropriate. Because even if we extend the sunset, there could be a time that we go, you know what, this has sort of outlived itself. And a sunset just makes sure that we're reevaluating on some kind of regular basis. I get really concerned about removing sunsets on things like this because then there's no incentive to reevaluate. We just keep going in perpetuity, and we see that all the time in government, and it's really hard to roll things back then. So is there a reason that we can't just reevaluate this every few years?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley. That's a good question, and I understand that belief that, you know, some things you would want to have end dates. I just had a bill the other day in committee that, you know, that I actually put a sunset on because I thought that it should be reevaluated because things were changing. So in this case, I think that we have so much work to do in this area. I didn't really think about a sunset in that regard, because we want this care to be available to more people because it is so helpful and it is something that will help people, as I said, live longer, have better lives. And I think it's here to stay, this treatment. I think as the study proceeds, if we decide as a body to make medical assistance and Minnesota care covered in this, and also increase the amount of coverage from private insurance payments, which are variable depending on who you are, where you live, who your insurance company is. This, if we get to that point, we're going to be putting it in statute. And even then, though, the council may have a valuable role assessing how palliative care is done across the state. So, you know, if we want to consider a 10-year sunset, you know, I might be okay with that, and certainly would be open to further conversations.
And I would just add to that, Representative New Brindley, that if you look at the bill, the couple things. One is it's a volunteer group, but the appropriation they're asking for is really very small, and it's only for one biennium. So there is kind of a natural sunset to that because the money is not ongoing. So if they feel that they really are doing something, they will have to come back for an appropriation, and so there will be. But I take your point, and I think it's a very good one. Other questions, other comments? All right, seeing none. So thank you very much, Representative Bierman. So with that, House File 1940 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Representative Bonner, House File 2160. And Representative Bonner's motion will be that House File 2160 be laid over for possible inclusion. And, oh, yes, and I've been asked to remind everyone that we're going to 12:30 today. So I think we are moving right along, which I really appreciate everyone's help in that, and I think we're going to hopefully be able to finish on time today, so at 12:30 or before. So the motion is that House File 2160 be laid over for possible inclusion. I don't think there is an amendment in the packet. So to your bill, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 2160 would increase the funding for a highly successful prevention program aimed at reducing fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. A decade ago, the Community in Recovery Aiding Families in Transition, or CRAFT, pilot project was launched in Olmsted County. With its success, the legislator created a base of funding that has methodically increased funding for what are now commonly referred to as FASD prevention grants. Utilizing Proof Alliance and their long-lasting partnerships with the Minnesota Department of Health, this statewide organization dedicated to reducing and the incidence of FASD in our state has built sustainable and effective community partnerships that support women and children in recovery. The state currently appropriates $750,000 each year to the Minnesota Department of Health. This bill would increase that appropriation by $500,000 per year, allowing Proof Alliance to expand the effectiveness of this program into more communities across the state. We know that dollars are in high demand, but we also acknowledge that each healthy baby born to an at-risk mother through this program will save taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of an individual who might otherwise suffer permanent brain injury due to fetal alcohol exposure. I just wanted to throw in here, too, that fetal alcohol exposure, which leads to FASD, is the leading cause of preventable birth defects, impacting 1 in 20 babies in the United States. FASD is common, it is irreversible, but it is 100% preventable. With more awareness and prevention services, we can greatly diminish the incidences of FASD in Minnesota, giving these families and individuals a chance at a healthier life and significantly ensuring each child can live and contribute to his or her best potential. With me today, I have Molly O'Brien, the Executive Director of Proof Alliance, to testify first.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Bonner. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to provide testimony to support FASD Prevention Grants Bill, which would help reduce the incident rates of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder across Minnesota communities. My name is Molly O'Brien. I'm the Executive Director of Proof Alliance. We have been around for 25 years. We're a nonprofit, and our goal is to prevent FASD and care for all impacted across our state. And as many of you know, each year, 8,755 babies are born with prenatal alcohol exposure. That is 13% of our babies in this wonderful state. Prenatal alcohol exposure is the leading cause of preventable birth defects, and prenatal alcohol exposure causes FASD, which is a lifelong disability, and it impacts brain function, development, learning, behavior, and social skills. And as Representative Bonner said, 1 in 20 children across the U.S. has an FASD. That's every classroom. It's in every classroom. And just a comparison here, I think autism is about 1 in 59. So that just kind of gives you a sense of the prevalence. So the mental, physical, and emotional cost of FASD to families is devastating. The financial cost to our state is shocking. People living with an FASD are more likely to need foster care, PCA services, waivers, medical care, mental health care, case management, and special education. And as you read from Humphrey in your packets, a letter from Humphrey, who's a father of a son with an FASD, he said, living with an FASD is expensive and often requires state funds to supplement family funds. The CDC estimates that the lifetime cost of a person with an FASD is $2 million. So the return on investing in FASD prevention is profound. So if we think about $22,000 per person per year, the cost of living with an FASD, in Minnesota, it's about $131 million annually.
So many women, let me back up. FASD, as Representative Bonner said, is 100% preventable if women have alcohol-free pregnancies. And many women, when they're given the clear and direct facts that no amount of alcohol is safe to consume during pregnancy, make that choice not to drink for that long 9 months. However, some women, right, it might be a few weeks before we know we're pregnant, and maybe we've kind of lost that window. Some women, in fact, one in five women in Minnesota did not hear correct information from their healthcare provider about alcohol use during pregnancy. And third, for many women with substance use disorders, it's not a simple choice to just not drink for 9 months, right? Even with the supports and services in place, abstaining from alcohol during pregnancy can feel impossible in the midst of chemical dependency and addiction. There's hope. FASD prevention grants provide community-based, long-term recovery support services for people that are pregnant or parenting with histories of alcohol use disorders. And these programs help reduce incidence rates of FASD by helping pregnant or parenting people, one, maintain sobriety through increased accountability and recovery skills and case management and connections. And two, connecting to community-based resources like housing, employment, transportation, and parenting skills.
And I do have to ask you to wrap up, please.
You bet. I will. So currently, FASD prevention grants go to organizations like Wayside Recovery, Avivo, and Family Services Rochester. We are serving a lot of communities across the state. On average, 93% of babies born are born without prenatal alcohol exposure. In fact, last year it was 100%. We're doing great work, but the current level of funding for these grant-funded programs are only reaching a small fraction of people who would benefit from these services. So I humbly ask you to support this impactful legislation. Your support now will change the lives of future generations in Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning.
All right. Thank you so much. Valerie Mengskow. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you. Please introduce yourself. I have to ask you to please try to stick to about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So my name is Valerie Mengskow, and I'm a woman living in long-term recovery. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm a mother of three children, Justice, who's 16, Faith, age 11, and Grace Liberty, who is age 6. I've struggled with substance use disorder and mental health issues since the age of 12. These struggles contributed to me losing custody of my two oldest children.
And Valerie, could you talk really close into the mic? These mics are not good. Yeah, thank you.
All right. In 2015, I was sitting in my probation officer's office, and I was 4 months pregnant. I had recently been kicked out from a homeless shelter in the cities. I had no income, no vehicle, no residence, and I had little to no hope for my future. The only thing that I did have was the realization that if I went back to using drugs, that I would die or end up back in prison. My probation officer encouraged me each meeting for months to join a support program for pregnant and parenting mothers, and I finally did. My initial plans were to place the child I was pregnant with up for adoption, but a few months after I gave birth, I second-guessed my decision and stopped the adoption proceedings. I worked hard with the support and encouragement from my peers within the program and my caseworker in child protection to establish and maintain stability so I would be able to parent my daughter, Grace. My caseworker connected me to resources within the community and walked alongside me as I dug myself out of the hole that years of addiction had created. I began to heal from opening up in group and sharing my struggles with other women who were navigating similar journeys as mine. The skills and tools I learned within this program helped contribute to not only maintain sobriety, but to be a woman actively living in recovery. I began to have hope for my future. After graduation from this program, I kept attending as alumni and was able to encourage new moms within the group. 5 years later, my daughter Grace and I are happy and thriving. I recently celebrated 7 years of sobriety. I'm an active advocate and mentor within the recovery community. I am attending school for social work. I serve on the Human Service Advisory Board for Olmsted County, and I now get to work alongside this very same program for pregnant and parenting mothers. I'm able to use my lived experience with substance use disorder and with the child protection system to walk alongside, mentor, and encourage mothers. By supporting expansion of this program, you will be providing more mothers, children, and families within more communities the opportunity to have the same impact of recovery and restoration within their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Is there any discussion from the committee? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And thank you for telling your story. I mean, you know, we need to hear more of those stories of success. I mean, recovery and challenges that people have. I mean, life has a tendency to try to break people, and I'm glad that you are beating that. So thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. As I look at this, you know, it's not a lot of money. I'm wondering, I have two questions. First one is, are these grants direct appropriation grants to providers from DHS?
Representative Bonner.
I believe so, yes, and we will phone a friend here to make sure that we are being consistent.
All right, Ms. O'Brien.
Thank you for your question. These grants come to Proof Alliance. We administer the grants to our community partners who provide the services.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many sub-grant recipients do you contract with then with these amounts?
Currently, there are three.
Ms. O'Brien.
Currently, there are three.
Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
And how do these sub-recipients work with the counties, because there's a ton of work that the counties do with this as well. How do they partner with the counties? That's first part. Part A of this, and part B is, how do you measure the effectiveness? What are the evaluations that you use to report back and say that this is successful? It hasn't been successful, and we're going to move in a different way. I'm not trying to be judgy. What is the evaluation criteria?
Ms. O'Brien.
Thank you for your question. That first question about how do our subgrantees partner with the counties, I might want to phone a friend in for that. The second question, during the grant cycle, mothers and children are, there are tox screens that are done, and there are throughout that grant period. So, and there are developmental studies that are done throughout that grant period. I can follow up with some additional information, but there is program evaluation throughout the grant period, and also longitudinal studies that are being done using Wilder research data sets, and I can provide a little bit more information on the longitudinal studies if that would be helpful.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. It's these are hard things to measure the effectiveness of. I mean, changing people's behavior is super hard, and the fact that you're trying and you're working, you know, towards that thing is a really good. That's good. I working with the counties, because like I say, I know that we spend an enormous amount of time and energy. There's an enormous amount of capacity that we've built, and so adding to that and working together is so much more efficient. And I just hope that we continue to do that. So. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Bonner.
All right. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. And I think those are great questions. And if you have further information, if you could share it with the committee, that would be very helpful. I do want to say that, you know, there are so many things that we try to measure in health and human services, and it can be awfully difficult sometimes. You can't do a randomized control study on everything, right? But when you're looking at healthy pregnancy outcomes, it's actually a little easier because you've got a pretty defined outcome. Not for, of course, everything they do, but when you can look at, you know, how many people come into the program who have a substance use disorder and have a baby that's born substance free, that's a pretty clean, easy measure. And I think one of the things that I like about this program is that, as I understand it, the rate of success on that measure is quite high. Is that correct, Ms. O'Brien?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Yeah, so I think that's a pretty, to me, very compelling. And this is a difficult thing to impact. And as they were explaining, I think the consequences of using substances during a pregnancy are just awful. And I'm guessing that the cost-to-benefit ratio here is a very good one. So that's kind of why I have a particular interest in this. And, of course, since it comes out of Olmsted County, it's something I'm more familiar with. But as it's true, that doesn't make it the only thing that we do or even the most compelling. But I'm happy to see that the intention is to make it go even more available across the state. So with that, unless there's any more from the members, a final comment, Representative Bonner.
I do have a final comment. And just in case you want, Madam Chair, there is someone here from the county that might be able to address the county question. And we can certainly talk offline about that as well, Representative Nadeau. I just wanted to mention that, you know, the mission here is really to have healthy moms and healthy babies and work towards that goal. And, you know, I want to thank Valerie for being here and sharing her story and really taking the time to do that. It's really difficult to share that, to have that courage. But, you know, having the ability, what I see in early childhood programs, home visiting, things like that, which I heavily support and have been the author of, what we see constantly is that moms want to do the right thing by their babies. They want healthy babies. And this program gives them an opportunity not only to get the help that they need, but to really make sure that those healthy babies have a great start in life. So I'm really grateful for the program.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Representative Bonner. So with that, House File 2160 is laid over for possible inclusion. So thank you very much. And we will go now to House File 2236, Representative Hassan. And so the chair will move that House File 2236 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I don't think there is an amendment to the bill. So I think we can go right into it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And this is a good segue to follow healthy moms, healthy babies. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2276. This is a simple bill that creates a small funding for a public health awareness campaign to educate many in the BIPOC folks the dangers of skin lightening. In December of last year, a woman in Minnesota suffered a partial vision loss as well as other symptoms after mercury exposure from skin whitening cream. In the package, it did not list that there was a mercury included, and it did not have any ingredients listed. According to market research global industry analysts, this industry is worth $8 billion was worth $8 billion in 2020 and expected to hit $12.6 billion by 2027. Skin lightening is when folks use products to change their skin tone for a lighter tone. I'm sure this wouldn't be our, you know, business or our problem if it wasn't putting dangers in people's health as well as babies. Pregnant women use this product and expose their babies to mercury. And if you keep this product in your house, the impact of, you know, kids inhaling this product, pet, other family members, it's really, you know, possible. Minnesota Department of Health has had done some, you know, studies where they found many of these products are from other countries, so they're not products that are sold in our mainstream markets, but I don't know how they get here, but it's available in the Asian market, in the Hmong, in Somali malls, in the Mexican malls. It's a product that, you know, promises a fair skin, but has zero ingredients list. It says it's all natural ingredients. Well, what are those natural ingredients? So right now, the FDA says that one part per million products is safe if it has one part per million of mercury. This product has 100 times that. And I'll let my testifier, you know, talk about this, but in 2019, this committee and the legislator gave a small funding to create a public health awareness that was 5 years ago. A lot of that, you know, money was used to create campaign to just discourage people from using this product and also, like, to ask cities to use some enforcement to make sure that these products are not sold in our, you know, stores. But, you know, in 2022, December, somebody lost their vision because they used a product that has a high levels of mercury that was not listed on the label. So the problem continues. And, you know, adults can do whatever they want, but when the impact comes back to children, and we know that mercury, you know, has impacts your neurological abilities. It also has, you know, people have kidney issues, liver issues, you name it. Mercury, we don't want mercury anywhere near children or adults or pets or any family members, but these products are, you know, available and easily accessible, and they're $5. You can buy them $10, any of the markets that I've mentioned. With that said, I have a young woman with me who's going to, you know, talk about the work that she's been doing in this space and how she's, you know, been talking to young women not to use this product.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hassan. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself and go ahead and give us your testimony. And we only have about 8 minutes left in the hearing, so we need to be pretty brief.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Fathi Ahmed, and I'm in support of House File 2236. As Representative Hodan said, I work in the Beauty Well Project as the program manager for the Young Women's Wellness and Leadership Initiative, which is aimed at raising awareness and education and addressing the skin lightening issue through proactive approaches by educating and equipping young women with knowledge and tools to resist colorism and skin lightening. Skin lightening, as you know, is a public health problem that's disproportionately impacting black and brown communities in our state. There are extremely toxic chemicals that are abundantly found in these products, which harm not only the user, but all those that are around them and the wider community. Some of the chemicals that are found in skin lightening products are mercury and hydroquinone. Mercury, for example, can negatively impact memory, thinking, attention, development, and success in school for children and babies. Unborn babies, infants, and children are specifically very sensitive to mercury, and it can impact their development even before they're born, for example, if their mother is using these chemicals. The chemicals in skin lightening products are associated with kidney and nervous system problems and can permanently damage organs and can cause like irreversible damage, like the woman Representative Polan was talking about, who had partial vision loss from using these products. These products are rarely disposed of safely and end up in our larger environment. They can end up in landfills and water and can pose harm to all of our health. I see the everyday impacts of skin lightening use and especially the chemical exposures. There are women in my community who have permanent damage to their health from using these toxic chemicals that are largely unregulated. There was a Somali woman in our state who recently had partial vision loss and also experienced a lot of other health complications from using skin lightening products. These products are creating so many health problems in our community that need to be addressed. And this bill will help advance education and outreach on the issue of skin lightening and associated chemical exposures, and can potentially prevent black and brown communities from suffering inequitable exposures and consequential health outcomes from using these toxic products. And I support this bill, and I hope you all do too. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So we can go to member discussion. I don't have anyone on the list, but I just want to clarify one thing. So Ms. Ahmed, you said they're unregulated. These are not legal products, am I right? They are absolutely correct. Illegal. It's just that people are still accessing them.
Absolutely, yeah.
So there is not a concern here that we're going after something that's legal. We're going after something that is illegal.
That's correct.
Okay. Other Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, then, any of the dollars going to try to sue or any other legal remedies? Because if it's illegal, that seems like that's the proper way to go after it.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Murphy. Not this, but there is, I believe, Congresswoman Betty McCollum is doing a bigger bill where she's going after some of these companies. But on this bill, we just want to do education and awareness and just tell people that not only are you exposing yourself to danger, many of these parents don't know that they're actually exposing their children to this, which is the bigger problem.
Yeah, Representative Murphy, this, these are illegal products, and I don't know what the regular enforcement is, but I think probably what Representative Hassan is saying is probably on a national level, because these should not be coming into the country, but they are. These are foreign manufacturers these are coming from, I believe, right, Representative Hassan?
Madam Chair, you are correct. Most of them are coming in through, I don't know, some way. They're ending up here, but none of them are like legal products. And they wouldn't be legal because they're so harmful that they're not supposed to be used.
Representative Murphy?
Just as a follow-up, too, do we know what the cost is? I know they talked about a minimal cost, but I don't see anything yet.
Representative Murphy, this is it is a blank appropriation here in the bill. So, I mean, in the past, I think it was like
200,000.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hundreds of thousands. It wasn't a big cost, so I think the hope here is to see how it fits into the budget, and it would just be a straight appropriation, I believe, for our grant. Representative Perryman?
Real quick, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hassan, good to see you in this format. Just a quick question. They are illegal. Are they also available online? So are people Googling them and then selling them on the black market online? Or maybe the black market's not a good word to use, but online. Thank you.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Rep. Perryman. Yes, they are available online. We had to, I remember 2 years ago, we had to write a letter to Amazon to remove some of this product because Amazon was selling some of this product. And they did remove some of them, but there's still, you know, other companies that have this available online.
Yeah.
Representative Perryman? Thank you. No other questions.
Okay. And I gathered from the testimony as well that sometimes it's hard to know because they don't label the products, right? So some of the products might not be obvious that these are the toxic banned products.
Madam Chair, the label says cucumber and turmeric. Cucumber and turmeric are not toxic. So that's why, like, some of the people don't even know, because when it says, you know, natural products and then it says cucumber and turmeric, you're not going to worry about being exposed to mercury from cucumbers. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Hassan. Okay. All right. Not seeing any. Oh, Representative Herr, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hassan. I just wanted to say I appreciate this bill so much. You know, I remember as a child growing up in my family telling me not to go outside because I would get too dark. Like, lightening our skin and whiteness is so ingrained into us. And so sometimes at all costs we're in communities that are do not have a concept of what this idea is, we'll do anything to actually get products to help themselves. And that this education and that amount that is being asked for is so small and makes such a great impact on our communities in helping us understand the harms of maybe some of these products that we're using. And so I just wanted to say thank you, because this goes across all communities, and especially in communities where literacy is not, you know, we already have challenges with literacy, language barriers, and so many other ways that prevent us from getting the justice that we need when we experience harm from something like this. So I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill forward.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Herr. Final word, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present this bill. It's something that is extremely near and dear to my heart. Like I said earlier, I don't care what adults do, but when your actions harm children, then we have to do something about it. And that's why I have been a champion of this bill for many years. I know that no parent wants to harm their kid. So giving that education and awareness and telling people that do not use this product because your child could end up having some neurological disorder, or like you will maybe lose an organ or become blind, would be key.
All right. Well, thank you very much. With that, House File 2236 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Thank you to all the testifiers and the members, and we are adjourned.